Representatives from several resistance factions and some other diplomats were in attendance. The mourners expressed their determination to gain victory over terrorism. Syria condemned this vicious act and expressed full trust in Iran's ability to overcome this agony and punish the perpetrators.
On behalf of the Syrian Arab Republic, we extend our deepest condolences and heartfelt sympathies to the Islamic Republic of Iran, its leadership, government, and people over this heinous and cowardly terrorist act that targeted innocent civilians in the city of Kerman. We support Iran in combating terrorism and punishing the perpetrators of this terrorist crime.
We are here to offer our heartfelt condolences to our brothers in the Islamic Republic of Iran over this tragic event. We are confident that this affliction will not hold the march of development, civilization, and advancement led by Ayatollah Khamenei in the Islamic Republic of Iran.
From this land, which is soaked with the blood of Syrian and Iranian martyrs, we want to tell our brothers and sisters in Kerman that our blood is the same and we suffer from similar tragedies, but our sacrifices unite us against terrorism and strengthen our resolve to defeat our common enemies. A similar ceremony was also held at the office of the representative of the leader of the Islamic Revolution, Ayatollah Sayyid Ali Khamenei, in Damascus. Attendees condemned the terrorist attack, considering it a clear proof that the spirit of martyr Haj Qasem Soleimani is still alive through his legacy, frightening the terrorists and the enemies of the resistance front. Ibrahim Wahdi, Damascus.
United as always, Iranians gathered after Friday prayers in the capital, Tehran, to show their outrage and acts of terror in the country after scores of people were killed in bombings in Kerman. They say while it was Daesh which claimed responsibility for the terrorist attack, the U.S. and its regional ally Israel are actually behind these atrocities.
Daesh is created by the U.S. Former U.S. President Donald Trump once said that Obama was the founder of Daesh. They have caused disasters in the country for more than 40 years, but our people are still standing for the Islamic Revolution. Are they blind? How did they not see this?
Israel and the U.S. have a long history of hostility against the Iranian people. Wednesday terrorist attacks in Kerman were an obvious proof of that, as they've been supporting different terrorist groups, including Daesh, in the region.
Daesh couldn't do this by itself. It has a supporter. Their supporters are the U.S. and Israel.
Mothers were among those taking part in the rally. I asked them how they felt when they saw the dead bodies of innocent people as the attack occurred on Mother's Day in Iran.
There's no doubt that Israel and the U.S. were behind this horrific terrorist attack. It hurts every human being's feeling when on Mother's Day they see a mother killed while holding her baby.
During the rally, people also mourned for a 20-year-old girl named Faizeh Rahimi. Faizeh was a student who was killed in the attack. Iranian students of all ages were participating in the rally to show their support for martyrs like Faizeh.
Imam Khomeini once said, "Kill us, but our nation will become more awakened."
Western-backed terrorist attacks in Iran have mainly targeted popular backing for the Islamic Republic, but the people say they will continue to support the establishment and hold heroes like martyr Qasem Soleimani in their hearts. Farzan Ashuryan, Tehran.
Yemen has resumed its military operations in the Red Sea by targeting another Israeli-linked ship traveling to occupied Palestine. The latest attack comes just 2 days after a U.S. Navy helicopter killed 10 Yemeni naval soldiers while patrolling the Red Sea. The spokesman for Yemen's armed forces stated that the U.S. attacks did not and will not stop Yemen's military operations against Israeli ships until the genocide in Gaza ends.
The Yemeni armed forces confirmed that maritime shipping is open in the Red Sea and in the Arabian Sea to the entire world except for the ports in the occupied Palestine. We also confirmed that any acts of aggression from the U.S. will not pass by without punishment and retaliation. We also warned the American enemy and any other nation of transgression by protecting any shipments heading to the Israeli entity.
The Yemeni public has praised the army's military efforts against Israel.
Today we targeted an Israeli ship because they are prohibited from the Red Sea. We will eventually march into occupied Palestine so we can get revenge for all the martyrs. America will not be able to protect Israel. We will continue to target them.
Although the U.S. and other Western nations have urged the Yemeni government to end its continuous military operations in the Red Sea, many Yemenis believe that the blockade of Israeli shipments should continue until the genocide in Palestine.
We prepare for jihad against the enemies from land, air, and sea. We've already endured 10 years of war, blockade, and Al-Taisa struggles. Therefore, the time has come for us to retaliate because their blood is not worth more than ours, or the blood of a Palestinian child who is dying of hunger and being burned by Israeli bombs and missiles. Therefore, retaliation is coming.
What is clear is that the U.S. will continue to support Israel, even if it means starting another war in West Asia. Yemen's Ansarullah movement had previously stated they are ready to take America on directly. Yemen has vowed to retaliate against the U.S. military presence in the Red Sea for the killing of the 10 Navy Yemeni personnel. They have also vowed to continue to target Israeli-linked ships and the ships of any nation that joins the U.S. in its hostile actions against Yemen. Yusuf Mawadi, Sana'a.
A mixed feeling of joy and sorrow has overshadowed the occupied West Bank town of Arura, the hometown of the late deputy chief of Hamas political bureau, Saleh al-Aruri, who was assassinated along with six others in Beirut, Lebanon, on Tuesday night. Here in this home, Sheikh Saleh al-Aruri was raised. He spent 18 years in Israeli jails before he was deported from Palestine to Lebanon. His old mother always believed that he would eventually be assassinated by those she described as cowards.
I saw him 20 years ago. He used to speak to me over the phone, but not a lot, and now he's killed. He expected to be killed. He told me that. He spent 15 years behind bars. He then was released and got married, but he was arrested again for 3 more years, and then they deported him. Those cowards sent him away, and then they killed him.
Sheikh Saleh hoped to be a martyr. And in all of his interviews, he said that he's not more precious than the children of Gaza. All the Palestine should be proud. We congratulate ourselves on Sheikh Saleh's martyrdom. And even if he's martyred, Palestine and the cause and our resistance will always live, and people will continue the struggle.
The family of Sheikh Saleh welcomed Palestinian mourners who were also congratulating them on the martyrdom of their son. The vast majority of the Palestinians, not only Hamas supporters, viewed Sheikh Saleh a national hero who spared no effort throughout his life to help Palestinians.
Thank God my brother, Martyr Saleh, was a Mujahid fighter who spent his life for the sake of the homeland. He spent years behind bars and then in exile. He suffered a lot behind bars in isolation and torture. But he was a hero, and he was murdered. We ask Allah to grant him the highest ranks in heaven. Despite all the threats, he always insisted on keeping up his position.
Meanwhile, a general strike was observed across the occupied West Bank on Wednesday to mourn the assassination of Saleh al-Aruri. Palestinian factions had called for joint action, as well as the protest rallies holding Israeli regime fully responsible for the killing. Palestinians across the occupied territories are mourning the loss of their national hero, Sheikh Saleh al-Aruri, and his companions. But sad Palestinians at the same time insist that the Israeli regime might assassinate their beloved leaders, but cannot kill the Palestinian resistance against the occupation and atrocities. Mona Qandil from the town of Arura, north of occupied Ramallah.
As a result of the threats by the Israeli occupation forces, thousands of the Palestinian families have collected only the most necessary of their belongings. before leaving their houses in Al Burayj, Al Nusrat, and Al Maghazi refugee camps. Similar to the other families who were previously displaced from Gaza City and the northern parts of the blockaded strip, these families have no place to go but the schools, the Al-Aqsa Martyrs Hospital, and the surrounding vacant areas in Deir el-Balah City. The neighborhood has now turned into an overcrowded city of tents.
We were living in our house before we were forcibly expelled by Israeli threats. Now we are homeless, living in this shattered tent that has no roof, no floor, no walls, and no bathroom. Our life is miserable. We, mostly women, girls, and children, are cramped in this small tent with no access to the basic humanitarian needs. We are suffering from unbearable conditions and the Israeli strikes.
The family of Dima Maslih was among those lucky families who could find a place in the surrounding areas of the Al-Aqsa Martyrs Hospital. 10 members, including the parents, their children, and a paralyzed aunt, are crammed in a small tent that provides no cover or protection from rain or the freezing cold weather. It's needless to mention their daily struggle to find food to eat or water to drink.
Actually, I'm a refugee here in Al Deir camp. Now, as you see, I'm in a tent with 9 families. You know how much in 9 families there's like more than 10 people in every family. And we live like literally with simple materials to live. Like there is no covers, there is no supplies like water, like anything like food or covers. Actually, no one do anything here. They just stare about us and they don't do anything.
Dima is a 21-year-old Palestinian girl. She studies translation in the Al-Azhar University in Gaza, which is now reduced to rubble over the relentless Israeli airstrikes. Like all Gaza students, Dima has her own dreams of completing her college, having a good job, and live a peaceful life in her house. However, the Israeli occupation forces ruined all her dreams, as the vast part of Gaza Strip is transformed into a livable place.
I was in my home. I was just preparing for the college in the morning. Then everything, this war happened. There is no warning. We just run from our home and we go to the school. They say, okay, the UN school is safe. I just wanted to give this message to the whole world. We need to stop this war. We don't need supplies like water and food. Okay, right, we need it, but we need to stop this war. Like, I lost my home. I don't know where I will back.
Dima is another example of the Palestinian student whose life, future, and dreams were ruined by the Israeli regime that has been bombarding the besieged strip for roughly 3 months in a row. This sort of the barbaric bombardment against the besieged strip goes beyond any description in terms of a brutality against civilians. Mota Abu Msabih, the central area of Gaza Strip.
A unifying figure, no doubt, a role model and a symbol of hope, self-confidence and courage. On his fourth martyrdom anniversary, Lieutenant General Qasem Soleimani is a source of inspiration more than ever. The reason why Tehran University has decided to recognize and reward prominent figures with outstanding works focused on the top commander himself and his way of life as freedom seekers worldwide and in particular resistance fighters in Gaza continue to look up to him and follow in his footsteps.
Today, the occupying Israeli regime and the Americans who were talking about destroying Hamas are sending messages and indirectly negotiating with Hamas about how to manage Gaza after the war and how to exchange prisoners. This all means that the axis of resistance has won this war, and once again resistance has paid off, the resistance that Martyr Qasem Soleimani stood up for.
Martyr Soleimani is not just a person. Martyr Soleimani is a school of thought. It's important for us to see the world through his eyes and follow in his footsteps. That is why I have published a book including my research on Martyr Soleimani's leadership style that can be used as a reference for our future leaders. I believe we need more people using his methods in leadership for us to be successful.
The 20 laureates were picked out of a short list of 150 prominent figures who have made great efforts to shed light on the different aspects of Lieutenant General Qasem Soleimani, both as a person and as a hero and the top commander that he was.
Haj Qasem Soleimani is one of the most influential people of our time. In Palestine, and particularly in Gaza, we owe our resistance to him. That is why we call him the martyr of Al-Quds. Young boys and girls in Gaza see him as a role model.
Martyr Soleimani is one of the greatest people in history, a unique person and a true hero. I think he is a great role model for our younger generation, and it's our duty to pass on his teachings to them.
He is very much loved by people all over the world, not just in Iran, but internationally. He is a symbol of resistance against imperialism, against hegemony, against arrogance, against occupation, against apartheid, against genocide. And he continues to fulfill that role years after he was assassinated by the criminal American regime.
In West Asia, many people who are fighting for freedom against global imperialism see their path to victory through his teachings and his way of life. And Lieutenant General Qasem Soleimani will continue to be a symbol of resistance for generations to come. Gisum Shahmadi, Tehran.
Our voice comes from the heart of beautiful Iran. IRIB English Radio.
The All-Merciful, the All-Compassionate. Praise belongs to Allah, who allowed none to witness when He created the heavens and the earth, and who took no helper when He authored the spirits. He has no associate in divinity and no support in unity. Tongues fall silent before the limits of describing Him. Intellects fail before the core of knowing Him. Terrents fall low in awe of Him. Faces are humbled in fear of Him. And everything mighty yields to His mightiness. So to Thee belongs praise again and again, well measured, continually and methodically. And may His blessings be upon His messenger endlessly, and His salutation everlastingly, eternally. O Allah, make the beginning of this day of mine righteousness, its middle prosperity, and its end success. I seek refuge in Thee from a day whose beginning is fright, and whose middle is anxiety, and whose end is pain. O Allah, I pray forgiveness from Thee for every vow I have vowed, and every promise I have promised, and every pledge I have pledged, then failed to keep for Thee. I ask Thee concerning the complaints of Thy servants against me. If there is a servant from among Thy servants, of a handmaid from among Thy handmaids, who has against me a complaint, because I have wronged him in respect to himself, his reputation, his property, his wife or his child, or because evil words I have spoken about him in his absence, an imposition upon him through inclination, caprice, scorn, zeal, false show, bigotry, whether he be absent or present, alive or dead, such that my hand has fallen short and my capacity has been too narrow to make restitution to him or to annul my obligation to him, I ask thee, O he who owns all objects of need, which are granted by his will and hastened to his desire, that thou blessest Muhammad and the household of Muhammad, peace be upon them, and makest the one I have wronged satisfied with me in the manner that thou willst, and givest me mercy from thee. Forgiveness decreases thee not, and giving injuries thee not. O most merciful of the merciful, O Allah, give me on every Monday two favors from thee: the facility to obey thee at its beginning, and the favor of thy forgiveness at its end. O he who is Allah, and none other than whom grants forgiveness for sins.
From Ontario, Canada.
Now back to our story.
What is it in there?
We will be talking about this.
Let me bring in Leo Sazdi. He's a professor of international.
The Spotlight.
Welcome to Spotlight. I'm Marzia Hashimi. Thanks so much for being with us. Well, new revelations about contacts of the notorious American sex offender Jeffrey Epstein incriminate pro-Israel attorney Alan Dershowitz. The new documents related to trafficking network of minors run by deceased offender has been released on the order of a U.S. district judge. There are eight criminal cases involving Epstein's attorney Dershowitz, whose name has been mentioned 137 times in the documents. Dershowitz is known as a vocal advocate for the Israeli regime. Well, the former Harvard University law professor is also a possible candidate for defending Israel against charges of genocide in Gaza brought by South Africa at the International Court of Justice. Former American Presidents Bill Clinton and Donald Trump have also been mentioned in the documents related to Epstein's sex trafficking network. Meanwhile, Jeffrey Epstein's sex trafficking scandal is also viewed as a blackmail scheme aimed at controlling American politicians in favor of Israel.
We have to remember that this whole Epstein saga is not just about a pedophile ring or some sex ring with a bunch of billionaires and powerful people. This is really about blackmail. The crimes that happen against these young people were crimes, and they need to be held accountable for those particular crimes. But the crime against the American people, the crime against, or even the world, is the blackmail scheme. That's the crime that we should be even more interested in, because that is potentially ongoing, continues to have consequences, perhaps has led us into numerous political decisions by our politicians that were against the best interest of the American public, but only for their own self-preservation, to not reveal some sort of blackmail. Could have led us into wars, for all we know. Those political decisions could have been decisions that ended up costing people their lives. That is the real scandal of the Epstein saga. It's not just about pedophilia or a sex ring. This is about blackmail and what that blackmail was used for. And that is what we really should be hunting down. Now, here's Alan Dershowitz. A lot of people are wondering, who was the blackmail scheme? Who was involved in the blackmail? What was the blackmail scheme for? And many of us suspect for the state of Israel, quite frankly, that a lot of these people, Epstein, Dershowitz, Ghislaine Maxwell's father, all of them connected to the state of Israel and doing the dirty work for the state of Israel to ensure that American politicians stay in their pocket.
And of course, as you just heard, not just the state of Israel, but in specific, that the Mossad, very much he's considered to be a Mossad agent. And what exactly does that mean if he had information on very important and powerful people, not only in the U.S. government, but many other places? We're going to take a look at all of this on the spotlight. I'd like to now welcome my guest to the program, George Zamudli, Senior Research Fellow, Global Policy Institute, London Metropolitan University, Budapest. Shabir Rizvi, political commentator out of Chicago.
This is The Spotlight. The Spotlight takes an in-depth look at the headlines, featuring interviews with well-known guests from diverse backgrounds to get to the bottom of the story. You can listen to The Spotlight every day on IRIB English Radio.
Well, thank you both for being with me. Let me start off in Budapest. So, George, you know, for example, if you're a member of Congress and Mossad has some dangerous, damaging information or film about you, would you demand, for example, that the genocide by the Israeli regime should end, or would you just look the other way when the subject was addressed? I mean, if we look at the current events and what is happening, and we see the reaction of many politicians, especially in Western countries, it leads us to scratch our head and say, what is this all about? I mean, how much money can you buy, can you use to buy someone morally? Or is it blackmail? I mean, your perspective in general.
Well, the Israel lobby has been extraordinarily powerful for many decades in the United States. It's also now become quite powerful in Europe, which is a relatively new phenomenon, but certainly a consequence of the increasing Americanization of Europe, increasing American dominance of Europe. But the Israel lobby operates with great strength, with great cleverness, great skill. And what they do is, of course, they fund politicians. More seriously, politicians that don't toe the line on Israel, and there have been a handful over the years, not many, but a handful, they have been destroyed by the Israel lobby. They target those politicians with relentlessness and destroy their political career. So I don't really think you need Jeffrey Epstein, who's a very shady character, and we don't know that much about him. You don't really need Jeffrey Epstein to have almost all of, I'd say almost all, I'd say all American politicians in your pocket, and now increasingly almost all European politicians in your pocket.
Wow, that's actually very frightening on so many levels. Shabir, I mean, when we look at the level of compromise and we look at the depravity, if we're talking about, we look at this situation with Epstein and Alan Dershowitz, who we always hear him spewing off very pro-Zionist jargon, but he is a very influential individual. He's probably going to represent Israel. I mean, what does that say about the whole political system?
Assalamu alaikum. Thank you for having me. And yes, I think it says a lot. I think you can just look through all the names that are related to Epstein from the very start to the names that are coming out today. Can you name me one person, just one, that's pro-Palestine? Can you name one? You can't. These are all people that have been bought, that have been compromised, or that willingly associated with these criminal acts, these acts that I'm actually not even going to say, these pedophilic acts, these acts of rape. But these are people that are compromised, they have been bought, and now they are puppets, essentially, for the Israeli regime. There's one more point I'd like to bring up here. You know, this whole Jeffrey Epstein saga, this Alan Dershowitz saga, has, you know, taken course over the course of a few years. Over the course of a few years, we are now seeing dozens and dozens of people implicated, you know, tied to these are high-profile celebrities and politicians. In our world, we understand that this world abhors a vacuum. It hates a vacuum. And Jeffrey Epstein has been pulled from underneath the rug. I want your audience to kind of think about, Epstein's gone, right? But this was a very effective way for Israel to kind of gather support for itself. Who has replaced Jeffrey Epstein? That's my question. Because this is an effective tactic. It's clearly gotten them the goods. So who has he been replaced with is my question now.
Okay, interesting question. Well, George, what does it mean for these countries? I mean, you said all American politicians basically are compromised. I mean, what does it mean for the United States itself and domestic policy? Forget foreign policy.
Well, of course, it's a very dangerous situation for the United States, as we're now learning day by day. The United States is seen in the Middle East, but also in the wider world, as being Israel's enabler. Now, that's not an abstraction. When people see the horrors of Gaza, and they realize, well, who's facilitating this? Who's making this happen? It's the United States, because if the United States were tomorrow to pull support from Israel, would vote against Israel at the United Nations to say not one penny more, then Israel would not be able to continue what it's doing. But the United States isn't going to do that. It hasn't done that. And the few times in the past when it's tapped, you know, even that's putting it too strong, it tapped Israel on the wrist, as George H.W. Bush did over loan guarantees for building settlements back in 1991, there was such an uproar within the United States. The Israel lobby went in ferociously against President Bush, and it cost Bush the election. 1992, he lost that election, and the Israel lobby's influence on that was significant. But just going back to what's going on in Gaza, when it's perceived that the United States is the enabler, that means the United States becomes a target for whoever. It could be jihadis and any number of America haters around the world. You know, again, we know this from, you know, what Osama bin Laden wrote now 20 years ago. He said, you know, what is it that really agitates us? And he said, you know, top of the list, Israel. And, you know, so bin Laden, that was 20 years ago. There are plenty of younger versions of bin Laden around who are very agitated about this.
Yeah, well, I would think most people in the world would be a little bit agitated by the genocide that is taking place, for sure. Shabir, your thought on the timing of the release now of Epstein? I mean, there are some who say that public opinion in general, if we look at what's happening in a lot of Western countries, there's a lot of talk about Palestine and this genocide, especially amongst young people. So usually a lot of times with the mainstream media, you want to switch to the tone a little bit and change. I mean, how likely is that the timing of the release of this, do you think, related to what is going on right now in Gaza and what the Israelis are facing?
Yeah, the timing of the papers is certainly interesting. We can go back and forth about it and kind of ponder on, you know, whether it was intentional or not. I think whether it's intentional or not, in the case of Alan Dershowitz, doesn't make that much of a difference, because at the end of the day, Alan Dershowitz publicly pretty much flaunts his criminality. And you have to understand the legal attack method of Alan Dershowitz. Alan Dershowitz gets inside a court, and he's an attack dog. He doesn't necessarily defend his clients. He attacks the people that are attacking him. He distorts things. He manipulates facts. That's been his entire legal history, as far as I can remember. And you have to understand that Alan Dershowitz has, you know, advised Harvey Weinstein, who's also accused of similar crimes. He's advised and represented Donald Trump, and of course he has, you know, represented Jeffrey Epstein. This is besides the point, I think. I think, you know, the timing of it is certainly interesting. For me, it's a matter of poetic justice because, you know, it really goes to show the type of people that Israel is willing to employ in order to kind of defend itself. But you also have to understand that this is a man that doesn't care what the world perceives of him as long as he is able to deliver the goods to his clientele.
Well, George, if we look at the overall situation, when we have compromised politicians who prioritize another government over its own, it's usually a crime in most places in the world. Why hasn't the United States not been able to protect itself from the type of infiltration that we're seeing and controlled by the Zionist or pro-Zionist elements?
Well, that's a very good question, and you're absolutely right. For many politicians on Capitol Hill, Israel's interests take priority over America's interests. We had Nikki Haley, who was being hailed as a at least the Republican alternative to Donald Trump, saying many times over that, it's not that Israel needs the United States. The United States needs Israel. Of course, it's never explained in what way does the United States need Israel. I mean, you know, Israel is a real problem. It's just an area of problems which is creating all sorts of major problems for the United States. What does the United States get out of Israel? It's never explained, but it's drummed into people's heads that that the existence of this alliance with Israel enormously benefits the United States. But just going back to the issue that raised by my colleague, I mean, who's the successor to Jeffrey Epstein? Well, there are many candidates. I mean, one candidate, obviously, is Bill Ackman. Bill Ackman, who has just succeeded in ousting the president of Harvard, by claiming, you know, the nonsense that anti-Semitism is rampant at Harvard, that people are calling for the genocide of the Jews, and so on. Absolute lies. But he's a man much wealthier than Epstein was, and he's now taken it upon himself to destroy the lives and careers of anyone who stands against Israel. This is really what we're up against. So Epstein is kind of, you know, it's dead meat now, you know. His heyday was already 20 years ago. He's been discredited. But now we have new people, very wealthy and very ruthless in advancing Israel's interest in the United States.
Well, what about that, Shabir? Because when you have such a corrupt system and with the type of money that George was just talking about now, so what protects a system? I mean, what needs to happen, in your perspective, to change things around in the United States?
Yeah, you know, it's really funny because anywhere else, what happens in the United States, you would call it corruption, but we've legalized it here, and now we call it lobbying. And so it's a completely legalized process. I mean, we have super PACs that represent pharmaceutical companies. We have PACs that represent the arms industry. We have PACs that represent big oil. And so what you have here are just different people with different amounts of wealth trying to buy their politicians, trying to buy law. What this comes down to is you have to get money out of politics, 100%. You cannot have these politicians influenced by money. There are various countries throughout the world that have, much to the surprise of Congress here maybe, been able to get money out of politics. I mean, if you look at Vietnam, if you look at China, if you look at like any country that has successfully ridden money out of its politics. Then you just look at the consequences of taking money, taking bribes, right? They take this very seriously. They imprison people. Some states even execute people. I mean, this is a very serious crime. You're betraying the people. You're betraying the many for the sake of a few in order for you to secure your own profits. And I think that's what it comes down to for the United States system. The United States lawmaking system, from everything from actually, I would say, the congressional side to the executive powers, you need to get money out of there. Otherwise, this is going to constantly be a representation not of the people of the United States, but of the multinational corporations that are based out of the United States that represent money, that represent, you know, the pharmaceutical industry, you know, the military industrial complex, and all these horrific things that are plaguing the world. You know, the joke has always been the United States isn't ran by a government. It's ran by three corporations in a trench coat. But that's functionally true. These are all corporations that want a piece of the pie, that are able to buy their politicians and then therefore enact law the way they see forth. And the way that, you know, that's kind of how the Israeli lobby also works. They have so much money invested in U.S. politicians, everywhere from Joe Biden to Fetterman to Richie Torres. They have both the Democrats and the Republicans in their pockets. And the only way that you can actually stop this is to, one, get money out of politics, and two, punish those who do take money from outside sources or from any source in order to create laws on their behalf.
Well, George, I mean, in the last 3 months, we've witnessed some blatant acts of double standards. We've seen students thrown out of school because of their pro-Palestinian views. Our professors have lost their jobs. And even this well-known saying, from the river to the sea, Palestine will be free, has been labeled as being anti-Semitic in some places. Now, we were talking about the influence of the Zionist lobby. I mean, how dangerous is this in general, that it totally can shape the policy of that country, foreign policy, but also domestically, what it means if people cross the red line?
Well, we've seen examples of this. We had those three university presidents who came before Congress, and they were harassed by Congresswoman Elise Stefanik, and she suggested, you know, very craftily, this Congresswoman Stefanik, that these three university presidents were tolerating genocide on their campus. And now two of the three have already lost their jobs. They've been fired, and the third one is in the crosshairs. She probably also will be fired.
Right.
Well, that's a remarkable thing. You know, because these three university presidents said nothing outlandish. What they said is they differentiated expressions of opinion, expressions of scholarly thought, and harassment, violent behavior towards others. And they said, well, as long as we have students or academics who are not engaged in violent, harassing behavior, then it's fine. This was enough to get them fired. Even though, I mean, by any standard, that is exactly what, you know, any free society should be based on. You know, you should be free to express your views. You can't go around harassing and, you know, behaving violently towards others. But by merely saying that, they lost their jobs. Well, that tells you something about where free speech is in the United States. You can express certain views. Other views, you can't. You get labeled anti-Semitic, and then worse, as being an apologist for genocide. Well, since genocide is the worst crime there is, and once you're labeled as an apologist for the worst crime there is, your career and your life are done.
Right. Well, Shabir, I mean, if the Zionists have penetrated most aspects of life in the United States, and the Zionist regime is in the process of imploding, what does it mean for the United States itself? Where does the U.S. stand?
Yeah, I mean, the United States, those that champion the Zionist regime for so long, for decades, who have acted on behalf of them for their own imperialistic missions, might I say, they will have to answer to the people that are now going to be asking, well, they just got accused of genocide, and you stood by them throughout this entire time. So, and not only have you stood by them, but you've actually enabled them in the form of tax dollars, in the form of economic support, in the form of political support, in the form of these constant vetoings of ceasefire resolutions that have now amounted to 21,000 plus people dead, about half of them children. Someone has to be held accountable. And these politicians and these celebrities and these influencers that have basically been ingrained in society, you even see it on the television ads, you see it, you hear it on the radio. These people will have to answer to a new generation of people. I'm going to say a new generation of people because, as I believe a poll recently was conducted, I think it was the Pew Research Center, that said that most millennials and Gen Z people actually support the Palestinian cause,
right,
and that the Israeli cause in the United States is slowly dwindling out. You know, the access to information and technological information at our fingertips has allowed a new generation of people to see that,
okay,
these crimes, These are actually criminal. This is actually completely criminal that's happening before us.
I'm going to have to cut you off. I'm so sorry, but we're out of time. I appreciate both of you, though, being with me here on the Spotlight. George Mueller is Senior Research Fellow, Global Policy Institute, London Metropolitan University, Budapest. Shabir Rizvi, political commentator out of Chicago. And thank you for being with us on another Spotlight. I'm Marzia Hashemi. Goodbye.
We are with you. What about you? IRIB English Radio.
In the limelight.
In Britain, almost 8,000 people were harmed and 112 died last year as a direct result of enduring long waits for an ambulance to arrive or for surgery, prompting warnings that Britain's National Health Service care delays are a disaster. We take a look at some of the world press and media's coverage of this story. Please stay with us. British newspaper The Independent has covered this story and tells us more. According to a major new study, thousands of Britons could be dying unnecessarily, as the United Kingdom lags behind other major countries on patient safety. According to research from the Institute of Global Health Innovation at Imperial College, University of London, the United Kingdom was ranked 21 out of 38 countries on four key patient safety indicators, with countries such as Australia, New Zealand and Norway rated among the highest. The report found that if the United Kingdom improved enough to rank among the top 10 countries, there would be 15,733 fewer people dying from what is described as treatable mortality, deaths which could be avoided through timely healthcare interventions. There would also be 776 fewer deaths from neonatal disorders and 870 fewer deaths from avoidable medical errors. According to the authors of the report, it is the first major international study of safety data that looked at 89 separate safety measures, such as waiting times, stillbirth rates, cases of sepsis, and the frequency of surgical items being left inside the patients after a surgical operation. Former Health Minister Lord Aradazi, co-director of the Institute and a renowned surgeon, said the report, which has been backed by the World Health Organization, the WHO, was a wake-up call for Britain and other nations to improve their safety for patients. Health Minister Lord Aradazi said, "You can't improve things if you don't measure them, and this is our attempt to engage clinicians in all countries, not just in the United Kingdom, to have better measurements and drive performance improvements." Researchers looked at different safety measures across four key areas: maternal mortality, treatable mortality, adverse effects of medical treatment, and neonatal disorders. Researchers calculated the number of deaths per 100,000 people for a range of patients, including those who died from medical errors and treatable cases such as heart disease, women who died during childbirth, and neonatal deaths from conditions such as sepsis or oxygen deprivation. James Titcombe, the chief executive of research unit at Patient Safety Watch, told the Independent newspaper, "Analysis of the data shows that thousands of lives could be saved if the National Health Service was as safe as the top-performing countries. That the National Health Service ranks only 21 out of 38 countries for patient safety is very concerning." James Titcombe added, "I hope this work and the publicly available dashboard can act as a catalyst in supporting further efforts to accelerate the rate of patient safety progress, both in the United Kingdom and internationally." British newspaper The Guardian has also covered the same story and tells us more. Almost 8,000 people were harmed and 112 died last year as a direct result of enduring long waits for an ambulance to arrive or for medical surgery, prompting warnings that the National Health Service care delays are a disaster. The fatalities included a man who died of a cardiac arrest after waiting 18 minutes for his 999 call to be answered by the ambulance service and was dead by the time the ambulance crew arrived at the hospital. The figures are the first time NHS England has disclosed how often doctors and nurses file a patient safety report after someone suffers harm after waiting for help. They show that patient deaths arising directly from care delays have risen more than fivefold over the last 3 years, from 21 in 2019 to 112 cases last year, as the National Health Service has come under huge strain. The number of people who came to severe harm has also jumped from 96 to 152 during that same period. The overall number of people suffering some degree of harm in such circumstances has leapt from 3,979 cases in 2019 to 7,856 cases in 2022, representing a rise of 97%. Rachel Power, the chief executive of Patients Association, said, "These data are alarming and show quite clearly the human impact of the crisis in the National Health Service is having on individual patients. We have been watching the disaster unfolding across the National Health Service and have repeatedly warned about the threat to patient safety because of it. Trusts are reducing the amount of planned surgery they perform after the government's refusal to provide a £1 billion bailout to help cover the cost of staff strikes within the NHS. Rachel Power said this would translate into even more patients waiting for care and potentially coming to harm. A total of 471 patients waiting for adult mental health care suffered harm as a result of delays last year, more than in any other specialism. Though this may be down to higher patient numbers. The next highest numbers were in the care involving childbirth, with 253 cases, eye problems, 221 cases, and trauma and general surgery, 207 cases. NHS England gave The Guardian anonymous details of 30 of last year's deaths. One entry explained, "Long delay in call answer on critical call, original call into an unnamed ambulance service 18 minutes prior to first related call answered. Call coded as cardiac arrest, once answered and patient deceased on scene." The English website of Qatar's Al Jazeera television network has also covered the same story. Thousands of junior doctors in Wales will go on a 3-day strike in January due to an unresolved pay dispute with the government amid crippling staffing shortages and worsening patient care. In August, the Welsh Junior Doctors Committee decided to ballot its members after being offered a below-inflation pay offer of 5%. Of the doctors eligible to vote in Wales, 65% responded, and 98% of those supported a strike. The 72-hour full walkout, which will take place on 15th of January, could see more than 3,000 doctors withdraw their labour from hospitals and GP surgeries across Wales. The Welsh Government called the decision disappointing and said it could not meet pay demands without more British Government money. In a joint statement, Dr. Oba Babs Osibodu and Dr. Peter Fahey, co-chairs of the British Medical Association, Wales Junior Doctors Committee, said the ballot results showed the strength of feeling. They said, "We're frustrated in despair and angry. We can't and won't take any further erosion of our pay." They added, "Our members have been forced to take this difficult decision because junior doctors in Wales have experienced a pay cut of 29.6% in real terms over the last 15 years. They said the decision to strike had not been made lightly and that members were not looking for a pay rise but asking for pay to be restored in line with inflation. They added, pay needs to be fair and competitive with other healthcare systems across the world to retain and recruit doctors and NHS staff to provide much-needed care. On top of this, junior doctors are experiencing worsening conditions, and so doctors are now looking to leave Wales to develop their careers for better pay and a better quality of life elsewhere. Junior doctors in other parts of England are scheduled to go on strike in the coming days, following unsuccessful negotiations that lasted for 5 weeks. Strikes by nurses, ambulance workers and junior doctors, which began with the first walkout in December of last year, have led to the cancellation of more than 900,000 operations and procedures by NHS England.
Comes from the heart of beautiful Iran. IRIB English Radio.
This is IRIB English Radio. Coming up is the news.